Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad Culp. It's March 31st. It's a beautiful, sunny, warm day in Atlanta. I have Sam Grass and Lee Cantor in the studio with me. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Brad.
How's your? What's this? Are we going to call this the official first spring day?
Well, weather-wise, it sure seems like it, doesn't it? It's a beautiful, glorious day outside. I have this morning a very appropriate, timely piece of trivia.
Pollen related?
No.
Pollen related, right.
Well, it could be, but no, not yet. This day in 1906, the Intercollegiate Athletic Association was founded, which later became known as the NCAA. And I know, Sam, you got to be excited about this
weekend.
Oh,
that's right. West Virginia. This is a big Final Four opportunity.
See, I was going to be very, very calm and collected about that.
Are you excited about that?
Nah, not at all.
In West Virginia, this is the biggest news.
Easy. You getting ready to get in trouble.
No, West Virginia, have they ever won the basketball?
No, and it's very exciting. Obviously, in that state, university, no pro teams, the whole 1.5 million or whatever the population is follows them.
Who was the famous player that came from there?
Do I have to go down this road?
I don't know. I'm asking
Jerry
you.
West.
Okay.
Jerry West.
I'm sorry. Don't take it so personally, Sam.
As I said, that's why I didn't want to go down this road.
Well, and so next week we're not going to have a show, so we're going to miss the day next week that
West Virginia wins it all.
And West Virginia wins it all. We'll celebrate the last of April
is what we'll do.
The other thing I heard on the radio this morning, this is a little bit depressing, that the average Georgian works 98 days to pay their taxes, and that will be sometime next week. So far this year, just in time to pay your taxes. Exactly. So far this year, we've all been working to pay our taxes. Now how do I transition to the show? Al Gore, that's your problem. Al Gore becomes a senior citizen today. Happy birthday, Al.
Okay.
62
there's
years old.
There's the bridge.
So 62 is the senior citizen, not 65?
Well, I guess it depends who you ask, doesn't it? But we have a good show this morning. We've got with us also from the Georgia Medical Care Foundation. We had interviewed last week someone from their chronic kidney disease initiative. And this week we have Mary Perlow, who is the manager of their Care Transitions Initiative. And we also have Dr. Rick Voiles with us from the Conflict Resolution Academy. Welcome this morning, and we're going to start with Dr. Voiles and with the Conflict Resolution Academy. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here with us this morning.
My pleasure.
We're going to just start by having you tell us a little about yourself. Conflict Resolution Academy, Conflict Resolution. We'd like to know a little bit about how you got into that. What's your background? So if we could just start there.
My doctoral program was in religion, and my very first introduction to conflict and cross-cultural communication dynamics was Jewish Christian Muslim relations. So that
no became, conflict there.
No yeah. conflict there.
Cut your teeth on that one.
So I spent a great deal of time working in those communities, interfaith dialogue, things like that, and then became a professional mediator, got the training, and fell in love with mediation and have been doing that ever since.
Begin by telling us, I guess, what is the Conflict Resolution Academy? What do you do? How do you earn a living?
Conflict Resolution Academy, we offer training and services to folks in the midst of conflicts, basically to make life better. So we work on every level of conflict, whether it's interpersonal, whether it's corporate. A lot of work we do with the government, building teams. I do a lot of consulting for corporations. when conflict has an ability to stall relationships and organizations. And as people are growing or as teams are developing or even as businesses are developing, they can be stalled by a particular conflict that either they don't know how to address or unwilling to address. And so interpersonally, relationships can get stuck, and Conflict Resolution Academy offers services on all those levels. We provide services to the courts, persons, neighborhoods, corporations, government.
So you said that you just were enamored with conflict resolution. I mean, that's got to take a certain kind of personality, because I think I know a lot of people that run from conflict.
Right?
They want to avoid conflict. What is it about your personality that makes you want to embrace that whole topic?
One of the things we teach is a collaborative model where parties work together. My role is technically to help people resolve their own conflicts. So as a result, I'm actually sitting here working on substantive issues, but also relationship issues that bring people together in the long run. And when I see this happen between two people or two teams, it is just elating to see this possibility to go from stuck, whether it's a personal relationship or even a team or a department, two departments, and see these folks actually cross that threshold and start reaching new levels of success, however you want to measure that success, whether it's relationship success or some sort of financial, corporate, whatever it is your mission, to take you to that next level. That is exhilarating to me.
Are you seeing common threads amongst people regarding conflict?
You mean as far as causes?
Right. Or,
yes. Oftentimes people will get stuck, and it can have a lot to do with personal feelings or someone feeling disrespected in the workplace. It's often lack of dignity, respect, poor communication, and so we can work on all those levels. In relationships, it's often relationships getting stuck, people or families getting stuck, so two people aren't talking to each other anymore. And that can go on for years, for generations even.
And then are there any quick fixes for this, or is this something that takes a long time to work through?
It depends. I've worked with corporations that have been stuck, and it's taken a two-year plan because of this elephant in the room that no one wants to work with. Or it can be as easy as 4 to 8 hours in a setting with a group of people, for example, families and care, elder care, for example. It's very difficult who's going to make the decision. You've got power dynamics going on. You've got, does mom have a voice? Does dad have a voice? Mm-hmm. There's usually someone in there who has a better idea. And people will often get stuck on one idea, and then they all fight over that one idea.
So how do you help move them from that?
One of the keys to conflict resolution is need exploration. And if you can get to the need of a group or a situation, there is always more than one way to meet a need.
So you can find that common ground and kind of point them in that direction and let them then kind of work the solution from a different side of the issue?
So by finding the need, we end up with multiple options. Now people have a grocery list of options to choose from, and it tends to energize the situation in a positive direction.
Have they tried this in the Middle East yet?
Every now and then I get these calls and challenges, right. but no contracts have been signed yet.
Right.
Let's drive this subject towards the nature of this show, which
yes.
is, as you said, as you know, are seniors, and I know you have a specific program for, quote, caregivers. Tell us about that, and how in a family setting, when siblings are trying to make decisions for their parents and there is a need, how do you address that, and how does everyone come on board?
Well, the first thing we have to realize is that people only fight about things they care about. So the fact that we're having a crisis here and the family is arguing, it means they care about something. Now, typically, it's the elder, whoever that is, either both parents or one parent. The problem is, how do we best express that care? One has an opinion, for example, mom needs to be in a nursing home. Another one says, no, the best way to care for mom is to get a home caregiver. So, and now these two or three or four are fighting over this situation. I can get them focused upon their the thing they value, which is care. Mm-hmm. And now we generate multiple options, and particularly with this collaborative model, to be able to give everyone a voice, including mom, if capacity issues warrant, and generate a conversation around developing those options and creating possibilities where most people thought it was not, there were no possibilities.
Like there was an impasse. But how do you get past that, the history of, well, you were mom's favorite, and, you know, you get into that kind of the family dynamics and the sibling rivalries that kind of are tangential, but they're kind of at the core of a lot of conflict.
Definitely, definitely there. And where most people get stuck in a conflict, not only is minimal options, they're stuck on a single solution, but they tend to get stuck in the past. This is about, now they start acting out their issues. Now, if I have to, we can do a side caucus. We can work with those
two. You give somebody a timeout?
Well, no, not.
Go to your room.
That's going to bring up too many
right.
And work on those issues if we have to. Develop substance and relationship sides of this conflict, and then get back in the room with all of us together. The key is to focus on the future, not the past. And people will keep dropping back into the past, but we have the ability with this process to keep them focused in the future.
So I think one of the classic arguments in a family is, how do we get mom or dad to give up the car keys? You probably have experience with that. I'd be interested in your comments on that particular subject.
Well, typically it's not about the keys. It's about freedom. It's mm-hmm. about lifestyle. And it's the fear. Most conflicts, then someone gets stuck with a photograph of the future that they are desperately trying to make sure never develops. And all of the acting out, all of the arguing, all of the conflict is to ensure that that photograph doesn't become a reality in my life. Well, if we can figure out what that photograph is, then we can talk about other ways to address freedom. It doesn't necessarily include the car keys.
You know, Dr. Voiles, that is a great, great analogy. I had that conversation with my parents, and unfortunately, I'm sure I handled it poorly because I flat told them that they were not driving from Charleston, West Virginia to see me again. And if they did, they were going to have to get a hotel room because they weren't staying at my house. That obviously didn't go over well, and it wasn't about the keys. It was they didn't want to give up their independence. But the picture I saw was them on the side of the road, broken down, two 80-year-olds. And that's the picture I saw.
Or even worse, in an accident that they caused and killed somebody else.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. So you've got two photographs, two people competing for this reality that may never happen.
And wanting the same thing, wanting the betterment of this, but the photographs were different.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
I know that you do training when it comes to the caregivers. Can you tell us just a little bit about that program and how you go about it, and who do you drive that to? What type of organizations?
Mainly, it's a facilitative or mediation process, depending upon which direction you want to come in. So I am an approved trainer in several states to train mediators. So I get a lot of mediators that are coming, and this market for elder care seems to be growing. So people are going, yes, that's a specialty I want to reach and be good in. That service, we look at complex group dynamics for conflict, whereas usually people get caught up in just a one-on-one relationship. Well, these are multiple layers of relationship and issues and history as well. So we have processes by which to address these things to get people moving forward, get out of the past, move into the future, be able to talk about those photographs that's driving and motivating their decisions. Complex dynamics, we look at the issue of loss because there's a whole lot of loss taking place in any kind of change. So the children, the siblings are losing something. Mom and dad may be losing something. We've got to take those dynamics seriously rather than just make a decision, solve a problem, let's move forward. There are ways that we have to address these loss issues all across the board. Communication issues, negotiation issues. Most of us are very poor at negotiating skills. So it's usually an either or, do it or else. And we give all of those skill sets to people that now step into this complex, multi-layered conflict and give them processes, paths through the forest.
Who is typically taking your course? Are you seeing families take your course, or are you seeing professionals like geriatric care managers, or is it a little bit of both?
Geriatric care managers, mediators, social workers, people that are already in this mix. The idea of elder care mediation is just new to this state. When we started doing it 2 years ago, there were only 4 states in the United States that did elder care mediation. We were the first to bring it to Georgia. And so part of our process is to let people know that mediation for elder issues exists in Georgia.
Now, is this something that a family should be talking about, like, kind of preemptively? Because a lot of times that when a family is dealing with some of these situations, they're during a crisis of some kind. And then they're just kind of, they have the drama of the crisis, and then they got to kind of sort out all this history and all these other things. Is this something that maybe the siblings should get together kind of, you know, way in advance to kind of discuss some sort of strategy? You think that's worthwhile?
Absolutely. The problem is right now, without the awareness of this as a possible tool, when they get into the crisis, they end up thinking in terms of attorneys. So we're at a stalemate, loggerheads, but fine, I'm just going to hire an attorney. And right. Suddenly now both sides have a $2,500 retainer fee.
Yeah,
now you're on the clock.
And you got more than one attorney. That's never good.
And here's something that most people don't know. The attorney has to represent the interests of the person who is paying them. Not anyone else in the room. So they can't promote good ideas for, say, mom if the son has
is writing the
I
check.
Mean, in short, an attorney cannot be a mediator.
Correct.
Yeah.
And a mediator has the interests of everyone in
right.
the room.
Dr. Vohr, so you were gracious enough to hand me a book that you had written before we began the broadcast, titled Understanding Conflict, What Are We Fighting For? And I'll allow you to plug that in just a moment, but I want to go to a statement that's on the back cover, and I'm going to read from it, and I'd like your comment. Is there someone important in your life that you just can't seem to get along with? So often, it's the one we love who are the most difficult to talk to. In regards to us dealing with our parents, tell us how we speak properly. Tell us how that applies to that situation.
There's a whole lot of, you could almost call it trauma in dealing with a parent, because the whole sense of these people have been here all my life to take care of me, and the loss of a parent is probably the biggest loss in a personal situation. I would say that and loss of a child. But this is a slow loss. This is a slow transition over time where the roles start to reverse. So there's an analogy here between your child who grows up to be an adult, and that's one of the hardest transitions to create, rather than a parent-child relationship, a now adult-adult relationship. We have it in reverse on the other side. Now it's almost, I'm now responsible for the care of the one who's given me care.
I'm sitting here, and you see my face. I've got this smirk on my face, and you know why. You know, we talked about my 18-year-old daughter out, and what does she know? She doesn't know what she's talking. And so I am in that parent not giving her due credit. Yeah. For her maturity.
In the midst of that transition yourself.
So yes. That's the real reason the doctor's here, is to give you private counseling?
I always try to find guests that can personally help me, I promise
I've noticed that.
Funny.
So, doctor, what's the biggest challenge from your standpoint when you're dealing with these people?
The biggest challenge is discovering the need. That is a skill set that is not taught anywhere in our schools, in our corporations. You don't see it modeled on television. So that mastering that skill and applying it in these complex situations, that's the biggest challenge. You just can't come. We are excellent problem solvers in this culture. The danger is we end up solving problems that don't exist. We are terrible need explorers in this culture.
And how do you do that? Do you have a methodology that you use? And in short, are there a few simple steps?
I teach three questions that you can ask, but there's nothing magical about those questions because the person you're talking to over 90% of the time cannot tell you what their need is to save their life. They have a solution, and they are bent on having that solution, but that solution is often not their need. It is only one option, where we need to find many. Many options will meet that need if we can discover what the need is. So the hardest part is I'm talking to someone, asking them questions to try to discover their need, and they can't answer the questions well. So I have to have a multitude of variations of these questions to walk these people through it. Sometimes there are people that are so cut off, they can't get down to the need, really what's driving them. Other times, and I can see it happen right in front of me, I'll ask the questions, and slowly this person is going in places they've never been before, and when I found the need, there's almost this epiphany. Oh, that's what I'm really trying to get. Wow. And it transforms the entire conflict.
But now, are these skills that can be taught, or that sounds like kind of a more art than science, that you have to be a good listener and kind of pick up cues, maybe verbal and nonverbal, in order to really know that if you're in the ballpark of this?
It's both. There's an art and a science side. And we spend a lot of time in our training, especially the mediation training, getting the science down of how this works, why it works. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, most of us don't understand how conflict works. So we end up bringing tools to conflict that literally run against the grain of how conflict works. If we had a better idea how conflict works, then we can bring these, then we can pull out the art, pull out the tools for that moment, for this person, and that, you know, after we get the science down, practice.
Right. Great. Dr. Voiles, for our listeners, what piece of advice might you give them relative to conflict management in their own families?
I would say there was two things I would really work for, and that is, one, try and get out of the past. The sooner you can get to the future, the faster you're going to find resolution, because all resolution is future-oriented. And second, if you can, take some time by yourself and reflect, what is it I need here? What is that photograph that I'm trying to make sure never comes to full development? If I can find out what my need is, then I will automatically come with multiple options.
That's a great piece of advice. A couple of closing issues here. First of all, tell us if we have listeners who might want to obtain your book, how can they do that? And then how could they contact you or Conflict Resolution if they so desired?
Conflict Resolution Academy's telephone number is 770-435-5009. Our website is conflictresolutionacademy.com. And they can get any information about our trainings, our services, and as well be able to order the book.
We greatly appreciate the information. This is certainly important for me, so I hope it's also important for our listeners.
Thank you.
Our next guest, Mary Perlow. Mary is the manager of the Care Transition Initiative for the Georgia Medical Care Foundation. Again, a mouthful. Mary, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Why don't we begin? I'm going to ask two questions back to back, and I'll let you run with them. First of all, tell us your background and how did you come to Georgia Medical Care Foundation, and then what is the Georgia Medical Care Foundation?
Okay. I've been a registered nurse for about 25 years. I am also a geriatric nurse practitioner, but knew I wanted to work in geriatrics when I first started working in a nursing home as a high school student.
How did you come to
be? My friend just dragged me. She said, I've been filling water pitchers over here at the local nursing home, and I get to talk to some of the residents and help them read their mail, and it's really kind of fun. And I wanted some extra cash, so I went with her, and I really found that I enjoyed working with older adults. I never had grandparents that I knew. They had all died before I was old enough to really have a relationship with them, so I never was around older adults. So it was just a revelation. I do remember one story. It didn't bother me to clean people's dentures. Wow. And I didn't think that was such a big deal.
That would lead you into dentistry is what that would
Well, I know, but I would go, you know, I'd go home and tell my family what I was doing, and everyone would get so grossed out by that. And I thought, this must mean something, that I just don't have a problem with this. So
it's interesting. We have a lot of guests say that they had an experience as a youth that kind of drew them to this.
You know, that is a common theme. They do learn very early that they have a, for lack of a better word, a calling for these senior elder individuals. And it does take a special person. It really does.
I think that's really what happened.
So I don't see this on your bio, so mm-hmm. I'm asking this not knowing the answer. But where are you from? Where did you go to school? Are you from Georgia?
No, I'm from Pennsylvania, from central Pennsylvania, a small town named Altoona.
Okay.
It's east of Pittsburgh, and it's central Pennsylvania.
And interesting story, I'm going to let you elaborate on this. You went to nursing school in Wisconsin, if I remember what you told me. How did you move from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin?
Well, I really started out at Penn State, and...
I'm sorry. West Virginia boy, I've got to say.
And my brother-in-law went to West Virginia, so I'll have to see if he were there this, around the same time. Yeah, he's... rejoicing now with this NCAA stuff. But I got married really young and followed my husband to Wisconsin.
So it wasn't
for
the weather?
There's a lot of issues around that. Wasn't for the weather.
Or the cheese.
Or the cheese, but I had never known this wonderful southern weather, so I still wasn't, I was still okay going to really frigid climates. I've also lived in Minneapolis, too, which... was even
That's
colder.
Cold. Right. That's
wow. But I followed him there. He was finishing up some schooling, or he was doing a residency in Madison, Wisconsin. So I followed him there and finished my bachelor's degree there.
Okay.
And we moved several different places before we settled here in Atlanta. And I've been here almost 20 years.
Okay. Why don't you then, let's transition over to the Georgia Medical Care Foundation. For our listeners, tell us what that organization, that foundation is, how it relates to Medicaid, Medicare, and what your role is there.
Okay, the Georgia Medical Care Foundation, we can now call it GMCF.
Thank you very much.
That'll help us all out a little bit. We are the Medicare Quality Improvement Organization for the state of Georgia. Every state has a QIO. And a lot of people don't realize that there are clinicians, consultants in every state that work with providers that provide services to Medicare beneficiaries. So we work with physicians' offices, nursing homes, home health agencies, and hospitals to help improve the quality of the care that they provide to Medicare beneficiaries.
Okay. So how do you do that?
Well, we work in three-year contracts. Every 3 years, Medicare decides what are some quality initiatives that we want people in states to be working on to improve the quality of the care. So GMCF, we're into our ninth, they call it scope of work, so that means we're in the ninth three-year cycle of working on quality improvement initiatives.
So for 27 years you've been doing
We've been the QIO for Georgia for quite a long time.
And what are these initiatives, current initiatives that you're working on?
Our particular foundation works on in five areas. The first one is beneficiary protection. That group deals with complaints that people have. If people feel like they're getting discharged from the hospital a little too soon, they can file an appeal, and our group will do a chart review and come up with some sort of a decision.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let me clarify that. They contact you directly?
Yes.
You are the, okay.
Yes. When somebody's admitted to the hospital, there's a Medicare packet that people get, and there's a little, we're the organization that they can contact if they have any issues.
So you're a government organization?
We contract with the government. That is one piece. The other four really have to do with working with providers. The beneficiary protection is obviously they're working for the beneficiary.
Right.
The other four themes relate to chronic kidney disease, and Joe Vaughn Givens was here last week talking about that initiative.
Right.
That's trying to help Medicare beneficiaries recognize early signs of renal disease.
Right.
What can you do? What can we do to prevent? We also work with diabetes disparities. So we have a program right now where the team is going out into the community to work with African Americans and mm-hmm. Latinos to teach them about their diabetes. So that initiative is fantastic. They're going into the community where the people are,
right.
Baptist churches and the Krogers. They're doing trainings everywhere so that people don't have to travel far from their community. Another one is, what else are we doing?
Well, you have your initiative.
My initiative. Yeah, I was saving that for last.
Okay. Prevention and patient safety are
yes.
listed on your brochure.
Yes, we're doing one with prevention, and this is working with physicians who
right.
have electronic health records and trying to help them be able to document some preventative things like mammographies and colorectal screening, those sorts of things. And our patient safety team is really our largest. They work with hospitals and nursing homes on infection prevention. There's a lot in the news about infections in hospitals. They're also doing some work in nursing homes with pressure ulcers and restraints. And those are some of the big things that they're working with.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead now and elaborate on your initiative?
Okay. I'm the manager of the Care Transitions Initiative.
Okay.
And what that is all about is we're talking about a patient moving between care settings.
Okay.
You can almost think of it as a puzzle piece, a puzzle with the patient in the center, and all of these other providers are pieces of the puzzle. When you think about being discharged from a hospital, one person can be in a hospital, transition to a skilled nursing facility for a while,
mm-hmm.
maybe go home.
Mm-hmm.
They're visiting their physician during that time. They get readmitted. They're discharged again, go to home health, maybe go into rehab, then the physician again. Then we move maybe to hospice. We need to pull in some community services.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to assist patients to try to pull all these pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up a little bit. This initiative is something that CMS has contracted with 14 states
right.
to do in a particular part of their state.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're working in Gwinnett, Rockdale, and Newton counties with the hospitals there, with their nursing homes, with their home health agencies, with all the community-based services that are there, and trying to pull in the physicians as
mm-hmm.
well. So what we're trying to do is to bring all of those providers to the table to look at how we can improve post-acute care and referrals, and with the ultimate goal of reducing 30-day readmissions.
Okay, now let's explore the last statement. Let's develop that. There is a large percentage of Medicare individuals that are discharged and readmitted within this 30-day window that you just spoke of. Let's develop that.
Okay. That is really the foundation for the entire initiative. One in five Medicare beneficiaries are readmitted to the hospital within a month of being discharged. And there's a large percentage of those people are readmitted within the first week. That's costing Medicare lots and lots of money.
Well, I think, and it's estimated, I will qualify
yes.
it, but it's estimated, and I believe you told me,
mm-hmm.
$17 billion across the nation?
Well, this was in 2005
Five.
On a study that was done, and there was about almost 20% of people were readmitted within
right.
30 days.
Wow.
And a large portion of those people, they did a huge chart review, and it was a very large study, and found that over 50%, almost 75%, were deemed by an expert panel to be avoidable.
Hmm.
And they certainly had their criteria for what they set as
being. So what were they defining as avoidable? What were the...
Well, that is just... Yeah, it's just really hard to say. What are some things that if we could have intervened at a different stage right. would have prevented
outcome.
A readmission? Some of those things are...
drug interaction is
that's huge.
Is a principal one, right.
But
that's
so from the patient's standpoint, and you know they're in the hospital, and then maybe they're going to be transferred to a rehab or an assisted living or wherever to back to their house. Who's the kind of the quarterback of this? Is it their personal doctor? Or are you going to now kind of intervene here and try to say, hey, you know what, maybe we should stay another day? Like, who's the person that's making these decisions? Because some patients have multiple doctors working on their case, and, you know, maybe the hospital has an advocate working for them. Like, it's from a patient standpoint, it's overwhelming. And then, you know, some patients don't have family members there to kind of help. And then, you know, they could be older. It's a very difficult and tricky situation. Is this where your group comes in?
Well, we don't actually advocate to that extent, actually taking a patient and moving them through the system. What we do is we're working with four hospitals. The first thing we did was go in and look at their discharge process, the workflow. What does it look like? And we were able to sit down and then map out that flow, who did what, and be able to take that information and help them using some evidence-based strategies that are out there that have been fed to us from CMS, things that have been tested and tried, and we can help the hospital staff integrate some of these strategies into their day-to-day workflow. Some of those things being What we've found through this initiative so far, we've been into it for 18 months. There seem to be three drivers of readmissions. One is the patient and family not understanding what to do. Another one is the transfer of information from one setting to another. Somebody's going from the hospital to the nursing home. The nursing home doesn't get the correct information, the right amount of the drug dosages. Several other things that can happen between that transition. And the third thing is just there's no standard or known processes for moving people from one setting to another.
Mary, yes. You know my background. We talked about that. And it is one of the principal things that's wrong with our free market medical system. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating national health care. That's not what I'm saying. But if you don't have a quarterback, as Lee spoke of, or as we spoke of, a gatekeeper, if you don't have someone that can speak to the family in lay terms so that they understand what they have to do, and that same entity coordinating the care between these various facilities, and in our free market, we don't, because none of us want that central agency, then you have this dilemma. It is a dilemma that we in the free market have been fighting for 20 years.
Right.
And it is hard to overcome. And again, please, none of our listeners misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not advocating big government here. I'm not. But this is what you live with, you know, based upon the alternative. Tell us for our listeners, if we reduced, obviously you said 1 in 5, 20%. If we reduce the cost of these readmissions, $17 billion, by, as you just said, a modest 10%, $1.5, $1.7 billion freed up. What would that do to the stimulation of our economy right now? I mean, that's a question you don't have to answer. I know I'm going to throw it out there. Tell us what practitioners, tell us what physicians can do. Tell us how they can help transfer this information to the next provider in line, so to speak.
Well, here's what's happening in the hospitals today. Primary care providers, physicians that are out in the community are not going into the hospital these days to see their patients. There are such things called hospitalists now. So they are physicians that specialize in hospital care, and it's very common. The four hospitals we're working with now have hospitalists. So I mean, it was a great thing to integrate into the system. The nurses, the staff had a physician there. They're there 24/7. There's somebody there to coordinate the care. So the hospital coordination of care is beautiful.
Right.
That's been improved. But along with that, what has now been deemed a problem is the primary care provider out in the community does not, there's not that communication flow of information. So lots of times they don't even know that their patient was admitted to the hospital. The patient goes back to see them after they've been discharged. They don't have any information of what happened, what went on. So one thing we're trying to do in the four hospitals, and there's a whole toolkit out there called BOOST, Better Outcomes for Older Adults Through Safe Transitions, which has been created by the Society of Hospital Medicine. It is the trade organization for hospitalists. They have set up a program for trying to improve communication. So there are some tools out there that hospitalists are starting to implement to be able to let the PCP out in the community know that the patient has been there. And it's as simple as getting the name of the primary care provider from the patient when they come in. Make sure that you have the name of someone and somebody contacts them. It doesn't have to be the hospitalist. It could be their coordinator. Somebody lets their patient know, or they fax over something. They text them that their patient has been admitted. I mean, there's all different systems that you can work on to try to improve that. But to do that, you have to get people together and talking.
Right. Now, do you get thwarted by HIPAA laws when you try to start doing that?
Well, I mean, that's always the first thing people say. But when you're we try to educate them or get the compliance officer to the hospital. We've had some sessions to really let people understand what is allowed and what is not allowed. If everyone is working with the same patient across settings, you can share information.
Right, exactly.
But people are so hesitant. I mean, that's been a big barrier and something that we've really had to work on, and we still have to work on when you're dealing with all these different providers across all settings. So that's something that we're trying to do with physicians. I wanted to kind of say a little bit about this whole idea of a discharge. When you think of discharge in any other context, it's not very pleasant. Mm-hmm. So we try to talk about maybe a transition. The transition is, how can I, as a sender, the hospital, prepare the patient and their family member, and how can I prepare the receiver for all of the things that they need to know about this person so that they can provide safe care. So that's the whole idea behind transitional care. What are the steps we need to do to prepare the person and the receiver?
So it's really about a well-planned and well-managed transition. And it has to be deliberate, because if it's not deliberate, it's not going to happen.
It has to be deliberate. And that's what GMCF, that's what we do when I'm talking about the workflow processes. Let's take every step along this transition. Go to the nursing home, see what happens when this person gets here. I mean, we actually do that and then try to fill in the blanks with maybe 10 people are doing the same thing and nobody's doing this thing. Let's see if we can get a little more coordinated. But the big piece that I haven't mentioned yet is, how do we get the patient and family involved?
Right.
I talked about the patient and family not knowing what's going on as being one of the drivers. So there are things out there to try to activate the patient and the family. If you're looking at this whole puzzle, the person in the middle is the patient. They're the ones that are always there for every transition. The doc's not there. The nurse at the hospital is not there. So what can we do to prepare the person and their caregiver to know what's next? We don't talk to the daughter that's in for 2 days and then going back to California. We don't give her all the instructions on how to take care of mom. So identifying who the actual caregiver and support person is going to be is a case manager function that we're trying to integrate. So anything we can do to activate the patient and family is what we're supporting.
Mary, can you tell us, earlier you were speaking of one hospital where you've seen some real positive effects of your efforts. Can you elaborate on that for our listeners?
Well, to start some of these initiatives, you want to pick a target group. You can't do everything. You've seen just in this conversation how fragmented it is, and you can just move from one little thing to another, and oh my gosh, how do you even start? So what we've tried to do is identify some particular disease processes that have higher readmission rates. If a person has this particular disease, they're readmitted more frequently. One of those is heart failure. Mm-hmm. Congestive heart failure is very, very common in this population, and it keeps people in and out of the hospital. So one hospital has decided, okay, we're going to target our heart failure admissions. We're working with the over 65 mm-hmm. group. So we help them kind of look at what are we doing now for heart failure mm-hmm. patients? What do we want to try based on some of these evidence-based? So we pulled together a collaborative team. We've got a cardiologist. We've got the case managers, their quality improvement people, nurses on the floor, the social worker. We've also brought in the home health agencies that they refer to and the couple of nursing homes in that area so that we could all try to be on the same page with our heart failure patients. So they set up several process changes to really focus on heart failure. The case managers, something in their electronic database triggers that this person is a heart failure mm-hmm. patient. So they get into the heart failure program. The physicians have come up with an order set for heart failure patients. What's included on that is a home health referral for every heart failure patient. I mean, that alone took months to just get that. Mm. So everybody immediately gets a home health referral. They immediately get into their heart failure classes. They're having inpatient classes. If they don't, and then there's a process if the person can't make it to the class with their family member, and we always try to bring the family members into it. So there are five or six different interventions that are implemented when this person triggers the heart failure protocol.
And what have been, can you elaborate on what the effects of this organization, this committee, so to speak, has been?
Well, they've lowered their heart failure readmission rate by about almost 10% since we've been working with them. They've been meeting since January of this year. Every month they get together. They review charts. They review all of the people that have been that have come back that have within 30 days. And the home health is there, so they can give their input because they only refer to two home health agencies at this particular hospital right now. So you can see who's going where, and they give an explanation of what happened, or we can see that they were just discharged home with no support. Mm-hmm. So it's a good quality improvement exercise on a monthly basis to come in.
A simple organization that talks, mm-hmm. that shares information in 90 days has lowered their readmission for cardiac by 10%.
They've been meeting since January 2009.
Oh, okay.
Since
2009. Okay.
Well, and it's become a model for their hospital, and now we're trying to spread that to other areas. Well, we're trying to spread it in that hospital so that we can target a bigger group. But they've been the model.
Good. For our listeners who might be looking at an inpatient stay. For those that are there and are looking for a transition out.
or for listeners who happen to be social workers.
Right,
or,
right. Mm-hmm. What piece of advice could you give them?
Well, it's all about trying to understand what's going on so that you know how to handle the next phase. Mm-hmm. So do not leave the hospital until you know who you can call mm-hmm. if you have a problem. Get the name of the nurse. Somebody at the hospital can answer your question if you have a question once you get home. Make sure you have the name of a physician to follow up with and their phone number. Mm-hmm. Another strategy at the hospital with this heart failure group is that they're making that follow-up appointment before the person goes home.
Okay.
What we've noticed is 50% of the Medicare beneficiaries in our little target area were readmitted within a month before seeing their primary care provider. So they did not get to see their doctor before they were readmitted.
And are you suggesting that appointment with a primary care physician sooner?
Within the first 2 weeks, if you can get in.
Yeah.
Well, actually, not if you can get in. When you call, you say, I've just been discharged from the hospital, and my doctor said I need to get in the next two weeks.
Right,
Right. So be proactive there.
That probably is as vital a piece of information as anything. That's great, Mary. Tell us how our listeners could contact you or someone else that may help them through these processes as you spoke of.
You can contact me at 678-527-3425, and I can hook you up with people in the community if you're in a particular part of the state. With people in your area that are doing similar things. Because there are hospitals all throughout Georgia that are starting to get on the bandwagon. You're going to hear more and more about care transitions. You can check out our website at www.gmcf.org and click on care transitions. There's a lot of resources for Medicare beneficiaries. You can download a personal health record. I didn't get to talk about that, but that's something that patients can use to be proactive. There's also something called a discharge planning checklist that you can download, and it has lots of information for you to look at or your family member to look at before you go in the hospital so that you'll be prepared and being able to ask the questions you need to know before you leave.
Well, we really appreciate it. We thank both our guests for being here. And I will go to Brad and let him close us.
Well, again, thank you to both of you, Mary and Dr. Voiles. We appreciate you. We thank the listeners for tuning in. If you want to listen to this again, go to our website, www.ugeriaradio.com. Next week, we will be re-airing a broadcast that we did with the Fuqua Center for Late Life Depression. We had posted that late, so we're going to give them an opportunity to for you to listen to that again. So tune in next week for that show. And remember, if children are our nation's greatest asset, seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Talk to you next week.
Ugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.